Do you want to be healthier, yet you just don't know what to do? All these shows telling you this and that, but nothing seems to work. Well, listen close. Golden State Media Concepts has got something great for you. The health and wellness podcast dedicated to workout trends, healthy eating habits, diet, and everything about healthy living. Join us in our banters as we help you not just live life to the fullest, but live it to the healthiest.
Welcome to the GSMC Health and Wellness Podcast, brought to you by GSMC Podcast Network. I'm your host, Stacy, and today we are talking about some common health myths that a lot of people believe, but that aren't actually necessarily true, and we're not quite sure all the time where these myths started and how they came to be. So our first myth, and I think it's one that a lot of people have heard before, is about 10,000 steps. And how you should get 10,000 steps in a day, and you possibly need a pedometer, or now that you can do it on your cell phone, to track your steps to make sure you're getting that healthy number of 10,000 steps a day. And if you get less than 10,000, that's not healthy, and you know, you may die or something. Probably not that serious right away, but that you're being less than the optimal amount of health, and that's not good long term. The problem is 10,000. That number is not specifically supported by science and research. So the idea that you needed 10,000 steps a day evidently originated in the 1960s with the Japanese manufacturer of a pedometer that they called Manpoke, which translates to 10,000 steps meter. However, that doesn't mean that the Japanese themselves also specifically believe in 10,000. It's rather thought that the number 10,000 was chosen because it has an exalted status in Japan and Japanese culture, and not necessarily because it's a specific number of steps that's required. However, it's not that, oh, I don't need 10,000 and I don't need 1,000. And we try not to say should here. It's suggested that you get at least a certain amount to be healthy. So if you get less than 5,000 steps a day, that basically equates to you being sedentary, which I know sounds like a lot, but when you think of the fact that, you know, just to get from, you know, maybe your couch to the kitchen could be like 20 something steps, that adds up really quickly. So 5,000, even though it sounds like a lot when you first hear it, it's not actually that much at all. And it basically means you're sitting around the whole time. That you should probably add, and I apologize for saying shit again, at least another 3,000 for a total of 8,000, which is generally considered enough to meet the standard exercise recommendation for healthy adults. It's considered somewhat active. This is not athletic or uber fit, but it's also not sedentary, and it's sort of that, as you hear with the, you know, 20 minutes or 30 minutes, 3 or 5 times a week or whatever have you, the number is now, that sort of gets some exercise without it being your whole life sort of level. So the recommended number there is 8,000. However, it's also suggested that the 3,000 steps more than that 5,000, which is sedentary, need to be taken at a relatively brisk pace of at least 100 steps per minute, which generally equates to a fast walk or a jog. Those steps also need to be done in increments of at least 10 minutes. So for that, you know, there are some people who would definitely try and figure out how they can reach this number without really working for it. Be like, okay, so if I just, you know, go run really quickly for 2 minutes, I'm getting my steps. You are technically, you know, you could get up to the 8,000 or 10,000 or whatever number you're trying to go for there, number of steps, but that doesn't mean you're meeting the same exercise level as the equation for those steps is expecting that along with a certain number of steps, it needs to be at a certain pace or to a certain level of, I guess, aerobic quality to really give you any sort of benefit. So even if you get less than 10,000 steps a day, you could actually be getting a good number amount of step, a good enough number if you're doing it at a higher speed. If you walk briskly or jog or run, anything that gets your heart rate up for 10 minutes or more, even if it's not 10,000 or 8,000, could be good. So for example, stair steps, going up stairs instead of just walking on a flat surface, and running steps are considered more valuable for your overall health, which is why you can get less than the 10,000 and still have gotten a healthy dose of exercise. And that just sort of exists for a number of different exercises that, you know, if you're looking to lose weight or to get back in shape, the best way to, you know, sort of work off calories is to increase the intensity of your workout. That rather than doing it at the same level all the time, as you go on to make it work a little harder each time. And so, for example, if you use a gym machine like a treadmill, if you put it on, there's a setting on most of them called fat burn, but it's not always clear exactly how it knows when you're in that fat burn level, because you supposedly have to get to a certain amount of heart rate or what have you to be in the fat burn level. But that even if you put the treadmill on a setting like hill climb or random or speed, that can be just as effective, if not more so, than putting it on a fat burn program. And you can also potentially do several short workouts in the day and get just as much benefit as long workouts if those short workouts are of a higher intensity. So again, there's a number of ways without it feeling like, oh, hey, this has to be a long slog to 10,000, and or if I work out, I have to go work out for at least an hour or whatever. And if I go on the treadmill, I have to go on the treadmill for an hour. If you have only a short amount of time, or if you're looking to get things done quicker so you can, you know, get off the treadmill and go do something else, that upping the intensity can be helpful. And this is partly why HIIT, H-I-I-T, or in some places I saw it was just HIIT workouts are really popular right now, because it lets you get a higher intensity workout in a short amount of time. So HIIT, for those who don't know, HIIT stands for, I believe, high intensity interval training. So HIIT, like the name suggests, alternates intervals of really high intensity with intervals of less lower intensity. And because you're having these really, you know, bursts of high intensity, that's allowing you to work off more in a shorter amount of time. So most HIIT workouts, I believe, are like half an hour or less. So this is a much quicker way to sort of, you know, get in and get out of the gym or wherever you may be. You can actually do HIIT workouts, you know, by yourself at home, rather than feeling like you have to schedule this rather large block of time in order to do a workout. But there is this belief previously, you know, that longer workouts and or more steps are all you need, that even if I'm doing it at the same level the whole time, it's because of the amount, and that's the only way to get the benefits. I have to reach, you know, this magic number of 10,000, or I have to be on the treadmill for at least 45 minutes to an hour, or I have to, you know, get at least some sort of minimum down. But if you're only doing it at a low intensity, it may not be giving you as much benefit as if you did less, but at a higher intensity. And of course, you want to do this only if you can. If, you know, you've got a medical condition that doesn't let you do high intensity or high impact things, if you're incapable of running, don't immediately be like, okay, I don't have to get my 10,000 or 8,000 steps so long as I just go sprint for half an hour. Please don't do that. Please do follow whatever medical recommendations your doctor gives you. But that if you are in a position where you can up the intensity and that is something you're looking to do, that is something that is possible that you may not have known before. So we're going to take a short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to the GSMC Health and Wellness Podcast.
This is your ultimate stop for everything sports. The Golden State Media Concepts Sports Podcast. Should I say more? From the NFL, MLB, the NBA, to MMA, it's all in here. The Golden State Media Concepts Sports Podcast. Listen now.
Welcome back to the GSMC Health and Wellness Podcast. Today we are talking about some common health myths. For some odd reason, I cannot say that word today. Some common health myths that people often believe that may or may not actually be true. So the next myth is about detoxes and detoxing, and the idea that a detox is the best way to jumpstart a change in diet or lifestyle. And my mother will sometimes do this where if she's eaten not very well that day or had like a big meal, so if it was like a holiday and Thanksgiving or Christmas or something and she ate, you know, maybe more than she meant to or more not super great things than she meant to, she's like, oh, I need to go home and drink some detox tea. And I'm just like, that's not how that works. That's not what that means, and that's not how you're supposed to use that product. What are you doing? But a lot of people do believe, you know, oh, if I'm going to start a diet or change the way I eat, that I should start it with a detox and get, you know, all these toxins out of my body and sort of start with a clean slate. But that's not necessarily the case, probably most of the time. So for example, a number of the detoxes are specific products beyond just a routine. A lot of them are actual products that companies are trying to sell you. But those companies don't all use the same definition of what a detox is. And so what one company defines a detox as may not be the same as the company whose product is right next to it on the shelf. Likewise, the companies generally don't even name the toxins that their product supposedly is detoxing you from. Because it's possible that it's not really detoxing you of anything. But the idea that you need to detox your body of toxins, if you're doing this to start a diet or lifestyle change, you probably need to sort of detox your lifestyle and get rid of those things. But your body is actually generally pretty good about getting rid of toxins on its own. That's the sort of basic requirement of the kidneys and the liver, that that's their job. And they do that generally pretty well unless you have a health condition. But if you don't have a health condition and are not, you know, maybe on the waiting list for an organ donation for one of those, you're generally actually pretty good. Your body's sort of detoxing itself throughout your life. However, a lot of people will, you know, swear by detoxes for weight loss, that they, you know, they went on the enter detox here and lost 3 pounds, 12 pounds, what have you. But that may not actually really be the case either, because most regimens for a typical detox actually end up dehydrating the body and causing bowel issues like diarrhea, so that most, if not all, of the weight loss that those people see is actually just from water loss. It's not actual permanent weight loss. It's just water. Which is ironic, because people who are actually looking to sort of jumpstart a new diet or a new lifestyle or just healthy eating plan should really actually increase the amount of water they're drinking. And that's really actually a simple thing you can do, is just increase the amount of water you're drinking and increase the amount of vegetables you're eating. And you don't need any sort of special detox or detox product in order to do that. Another thing some people will swear by is gluten-free. Gluten-free is a thing that's become really big in the past decade or so. A lot of gluten-free products now available, which is great if you do actually have, you know, a gluten allergy. But for most people, you don't actually need to have a gluten-free diet, and it might not actually really have an effect, because gluten is only really bad for those who do have a celiac disease or gluten intolerance. But that for the rest of us, it doesn't really affect us. And so cutting gluten out, even people who say, you know, oh, I've lost a whole lot of weight of cutting gluten out, that may be because you're also cutting out just the specific products themselves that maybe weren't necessarily the healthiest, but there's healthier alternatives of those same products that still also have gluten. But it's just that you, by having to find gluten-free products or gluten-free meals, we're cutting out the less than great food products that you didn't necessarily need to be eating anyways. Another myth, and I so wish I had known this as a child, because I would have completely fought for it like every time I was sick, is this idea that if you're sick, if you have a cold, you should stay away from dairy. That if you're sick, you know, you shouldn't drink milk or ice cream if you're really dying for some ice cream, because that will sort of increase the mucus production or whatever. But science actually shows that dairy most likely doesn't increase mucus production, and that actually eating frozen dairy products can soothe a sore throat that you would often have with a cold, and can provide calories when you otherwise wouldn't feel like eating. So mom, if you're listening, you really should have given me ice cream every time I was sick. No, I'm kidding. But that I especially like that for the second one of, I mean, it makes sense, and that probably would have been why I would have argued for it, is I have a sore throat. I don't want anything else. I kind of just want something cold. There's not really that many cold products that aren't, you know, sort of dessertish. So give me ice cream. And this is, you know, why there's that whole thing about, you know, if you get your tonsils out, you can have all the ice cream or jello you want, because it's soothing for your throat and it's not hard. But that even, you know, if ice cream is the only thing you feel you can get down because it soothes your throat, if you're really sick and not eating anything, you can definitely feel at times like, I don't want anything. I can't take any food right now. I can't. But that's obviously not helpful when you're sick and your body is actually burning through a lot of calories trying to help you to get better. You do still need to be taking calories even if you don't feel like it. And so if the only thing is ice cream, it's maybe better than nothing. You know, take that as an excuse to indulge or whatever. Mom, where was my ice cream when I was sick? Seriously. But also another myth about eating is the waiting an hour after eating before swimming. And this one, I'm still surprised that people still believe, because I thought this was just, you know, an old wives' tale, even when I was a child, and can't remember actually ever being forced to sit down and wait after eating before I was like allowed to go in a pool or something. But we didn't have a pool in our backyard, so if we were at a pool, it was very specific and we, you know, had to sort of make a trip of it. But yeah, I cannot for the life of me ever think if anyone in my family ever was like, no, you just ate, you can't go in. And if they did, I think I just went in anyways and then didn't have a cramp. So it was like, ha, see, told you. But that a lot of research has been done on this. And the idea is that, you know, if you've just eaten, all like your blood has flown to your digestive system to digest the food. And so it's not there in your muscles. And so you may get a cramp. But there really isn't any research to support that idea. I'm sure there must be someone at least who got a cramp after eating, but that research doesn't suggest that there is any sort of cause and effect situation there, that's more just a coincidence than anything else. Though, I mean, I normally just wouldn't want to immediately get up and do something physical after eating. So maybe it's just our natural inclination to sort of take a moment and let our body digest. But that even if it's not, even if you are like, and children tend to do this more of like, okay, cool, I totally just downed a hot dog. Now I'm about to go like cannonball into the pool. You should be pretty fine, provided you, you know, don't trip and fall or land on anybody else in your cannonball. So long as you do all the other stuff safely, the eating thing is really not going to mess you up. So by all means, please feel free to go ahead and jump in the pool. Not maybe not immediately, but you do not have to wait an hour after eating before swimming. That's a myth. So we're going to take another short break. Stay tuned.
Tired of searching the vast jungle of podcasts? Now listen close and hear this out. There's a podcast network that covers just about everything that you've been searching. The Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network is here. Nothing less than a podcast bliss with endless hours of podcast coverage. From news, sports, music, fashion, cooking, entertainment, fantasy, football, and so much more. So stop lurking around and go straight out to the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. Guaranteed to fill that podcast itch. Whatever it may be. Visit us at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And download us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play.
Welcome back. Today we're talking about commonly believed health myths that may or may not be true. And one of the ones I love is the cracking your knuckles causes arthritis thing. And I love it because I totally believed this for so long. And I do not have a habit of cracking my knuckles, but there were some times where I cracked them unintentionally and then just sort of like freaked out. It's like, oh man, I'm gonna have arthritis before I'm like 70. Oh, my hands are gonna be all like harsh and numb and gnarled and what do I do. But that evidently that's actually not the case, and that what happens when you're cracking your knuckles is that there are gas bubbles sort of in between them, and that when you're cracking them, that's where the sound comes, is from the popping of the gas bubbles. That's still a little weird to me because where are these gas bubbles coming from and how did you get between my knuckles? But my body does a whole bunch of other strange things. So, I won't question that too much, as long as the whole, oh, this bad habit leads to arthritis thing is not, I'm good. I'm okay. Thank you for that. Another one, and again, arguing with my mother, the idea that going out with wet hair or being cold will give you a cold. And I can't remember when I first learned this was not the case, but I do remember years later, rewatching an old Magic School Bus episode. And I may be showing my age there by that reference, where they go to outer space. And that episode is actually a bit different from the book. Arnold's cousin is still there, or his sister, whoever she is. But in the book, she kind of just doesn't really do anything except read the notes when Miss Frizzle goes off. But in the episode, she's definitely sort of a driving factor of the plot, to the point that Arnold at the end takes his helmet off on Pluto, which at that point was still considered a planet, and freezes. And so we all have to rush back to Earth to make sure he's okay. That's not how space happens. You'd be dead immediately, but children's show, so we'll just go with it. But then it promoted the idea that, oh, because he had taken off his helmet on Pluto, which was this really cold planet, and frozen, that he got a cold from that because he froze and was cold. And that's not how that works. Being cold by itself will not give you a cold. What tends to happen, why people, I think this myth came to be, is that rhinovirus, which causes the common cold, tends to thrive in lower temperatures. And so it's more likely that you will get it in colder temperatures. And so there's the idea that, oh, it's because I was cold that gave me a cold. But that's not actually the case. Another strange one is the 5-second rule, which I remember as a child just not really buying this idea that, like, oh, so long as you get the food off the ground in 5 seconds, it's good. I'm just like, but it touched the ground. Shouldn't it all automatically, like, be dirty? And actually, yes, that's kind of the case. Bacteria can contaminate your food within milliseconds. So 5 seconds is way more time than it needs to go from the ground or the floor to your food. However, I mean, I don't want to say that's not a problem, but at the same time, I don't want to say, you dropped your really great thing that you spent however long making on the ground and now you have nothing to eat. It's sort of a whatever you're yourself willing to risk sort of thing. Just know that bacteria can get there in milliseconds, but that moist food tends to contract bacteria more easily than dry food, and that the safety of whether or not you even should consider eating something that's dropped on the ground depends not so much on timing, but on how clean the surface of the floor is. So if you know, and I thought this was kind of obvious as a child, but maybe not, if you know you dropped it like outside on the sidewalk where who knows what has been on that sidewalk, you probably don't want to eat that. If you dropped it on, you know, maybe your floor inside the house and you're generally pretty fastidious about keeping things clean and you know all the germs in that house because they're generally yours and you don't have strange people coming through, it's up to you, I guess you could say. I mean, I have definitely done that. If I dropped like a Pop-Tart or something on the kitchen floor and picked it up real quick, be like, you know what? I feel actually okay, pretty clean about this floor, and I brush it off and blow it off. And I think whatever bacteria that was on my clean floor, I'm kind of already exposed to. So I think I'll be okay if I do that. But other things, like especially anything moist, I'm just like, man, that really sucks. But I am not even going to try eating that. So what else can I eat? So to each their own, but just so you know, the 5-second rule is not a thing. Bacteria moves super, super fast. Also, and this I had no clue about, and I feel like I've heard things in reverse of this, so maybe consider yourself, but the idea that you do not need to rinse your teeth after you brush them, and that actually rinsing can be detrimental, because most toothpaste contains some amount of fluoride, which is used to help rebuild, if not the enamel, the mineral of your teeth. It's helped to be used to rebuild and protect your teeth from sort of disintegrating and to sort of strengthen them. Though you probably shouldn't fully believe claims that toothpaste make about that. And I've actually seen some where they're like, yeah, we rebuild your enamel. And I looked at the active ingredient and it's like the same amount as just a regular toothpaste active ingredient. I'm just like, okay. But that by immediately rinsing your mouth out, you're not leaving the toothpaste with that small amount of fluoride on your teeth long enough to really have an effect. This may or may not be a problem for you, depending on, you know, possibly where you live and the water source. I know, I believe where I live, or at least I was told this, does have fluoride in the water, that was a thing they put in because they wanted to help at least poor children have healthier teeth or something. I remember there was something they did when I was very young in school where they gave us fluoride as well, though I don't quite remember why. And now I'm just thinking of Dr. Strangelove and that whole thing about fluoridated water, which is hilarious. Dr. Strangelove is strange for me because when I first saw it, I did not know it was a comedy. And so went in thinking it was a serious drama and just spent the whole movie going, what the heck is this? But if you haven't seen Dr. Strangelove, Sterling Hayden as the general who's upset about fluoridated water is pretty fantastic. But that some dentists recommend not rinsing your teeth. To get back on topic, to not rinse your teeth after you brush them. But at the same time, I do know too much toothpaste can be somewhat dangerous. So you probably do still want to definitely spit and not swallow it, but that you don't necessarily need to rinse your teeth out afterwards unless you're rinsing with like a fluoride mouthwash. Although since you're spitting that out later, I don't know. But just the idea that the fluoride in your toothpaste takes a bit more time to really have any effect on your teeth than a very quick brushing would allow. And so that maybe you want to consider how you can leave that fluoride on a little longer without ingesting it. So I hope that that strange way of talking about myths was at least somewhat helpful for you. Tune in next time to the GSMC Health and Wellness Podcast. I'll see you then.
You've been listening to the Golden State Media Concepts Health and Wellness Podcast, part of the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. You can find this show and others like it at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Download our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Just type in GSMC to find all the shows from the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network, from movies to music, from sports to entertainment, and even weird news. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. Thank you, and we hope you have enjoyed today's program.